before I bury my head and start drooling a little bit, I just want to give a little bit of background on the kind of work that I've been doing since I published Music in Urban Geography, because it was published about 3 years ago, and at that time I was more concerned with discourses concerning post-Fordist restructuring in cities and what kind of consequences that had for musical life in cities of the developed world. I can find myself in the developed world. I figure that's already enough territory to cover. And since then, I've been doing work that has a lot more to do with more recent debates and discourses that is done by urban geographers, that is done by economic geographers and sociologists. So my disciplinary approach to this is a little bit different from those that often go on in the field, and I hope that we can get maybe some kind of discussion going and find ways to connect these things all together. One of the things that I've been finding, I'm just hoping I can work this thing right. One of the things I've been finding particularly, hold on a second, resume slideshow. Is that working? Yes. One of the things I've been finding particularly interesting about the difference between how we in music studies often talk about cities and how it is that geographers have been talking about cities is that there's been a whole range of debates going among geographers for a good 20, 30 years about what it is that makes creative cities. You might have heard of geography conferences concerning creative cities. Creative cities is really a discourse that has been used by geographers and urban planners since roughly the early 1980s. It really started out in Thatcherite Britain as part of the ways they were trying to generate new industries after, of course, the devastating loss of industries in the 1960s, well, mid-60s through the end of the 70s. And geographers ever since then have been debating how it is that you make cities creative. And by creative, they mean both in the narrower sense that we tend to use creative, meaning artistically creative and also economically productive. These kinds of things tend to grow together in the ways that economic geographers talk about cities. But music and art and design have always played a crucial central role in how it is that economic geographers talk about revitalizing cities in the developed world now that we no longer really manufacture much of anything. And that's a real problem for cities, and it's a real problem for urban planners. And music has been, along with the other arts and design industries, has been used as a way to try to revitalize neighborhoods and cities since that time. And now, probably just about any city that you can name in the developed world at some point or other has had some kind of project based on music and other performing arts and other creative arts as an attempt to try to promote development. And at the same time, during all of this, all of the 30 years since this started, debates have been raging among geographers, urban studies scholars, and sociologists about how it is that art and design-related activity can, one, flourish in particular cities at particular times, and two, revitalize cities economically. Strangely enough, music scholars have not been involved in this discussion. It's all gone on in our absence. And the basic problem that comes up, the basic question that gets debated back and forth is, just how much does physical proximity of workers enhance the value of musical production? One of the most basic facts about cities that anybody knows, even people who've never been to a city, is that cities involve physical proximity. It involves face-to-face contact and interaction with people. And the debate has spurred, that word was supposed to be spurred. It didn't quite come out that way, but that's what it was supposed to be. The debate has spurred a lot of theories about how it is that physical proximity develops what economic geographers call untraded interdependencies, which basically means stuff you're not needing to produce, but that actually goes into helping you produce stuff. So for example, if you're in an environment with a lot of other creative musicians, there's a lot of information that you end up exchanging that you don't mean to be commercialized, but which goes into commercial production. And this untraded interdependencies, that's a term from a geographer called Michael Storper. These untraded interdependencies are supposedly a big part of what makes cities buzz, what makes them lively places for learning. And these are externalities that, and I'm now quoting Storper, that take the form of conventions, informal rules, and habits that coordinate economic actors under conditions of uncertainty. The uncertainty thing is a huge thing in economics. These relations constitute region-specific assets in production. So what he's talking about is that in creative conditions in which there is uncertainty about production, you don't know whether the music that you're producing is going to be successful in the economic sense of successful, or maybe even artistically successful, that learning works better with these kinds of externalities in these places where you are physically located near each other. Theories that try to explain clustering of creative activities, industries, very often concentrate on those kinds of learning and innovation that require this kind of physical proximity. And Allen and Storper and Venables are sort of some of the classic literature in that. The activities or sectors that require face-to-face contact for learning and innovation, presumably, are those for which information, and now quoting again Storper and Venables, for which information is imperfect, rapidly changing, and not easily codified. Now, I'm stressing that not easily codified thing because to me, this is one of the key things that makes music, if not unique, at least an extreme example of the kinds of activity that require some kind of urban agglomeration to work. And the reason for this is that a knowledge of musical performance is among the hardest things to codify, or at least seems to be something that we only very rarely codify and not to a very great extent. And thus, by what Storper and Venables say, it's one of those things that requires this kind of face-to-face contact for learning. Musical communities, whether you're talking about a conservatory, you know, a formal community of music learning and innovation, or whether you're talking about a more informal one, like say, a band that plays music, or whether you're talking about groups of DJs that live in cities that listen to each other's music. Musical learning is something that tends to be done in terms of music. That's why, for example, if you go and listen to a conservatory instruction class, very often the teacher or someone who's doing a master class will give commentary by singing something, right? Or by playing something on the instrument. It's not something that we codify very thoroughly. We tend to communicate musical principles in terms of some kind of music. And that lack of codification is one of the things that makes face-to-face learning so important for musical innovation. Another aspect of musical learning and cities, which makes cities such an important place for musical learning, is the rather thin line that you get and easily permeable line you get in the lives of music-related careers between work and leisure. The kinds of musical learning that and production that go on in cities straddle that line, or often make it something close to irrelevant. Keith Negus describes this very well in the book he published a few years back about music, about the music industry. And it is in itself a characteristic commonly cited as a significant aspect of post-Fordist production, back when people used to talk about post-Fordism. Crucial information to producing marketable music, in other words, is conveyed in a shared environment of consumption, not just of production. And the skills and behaviors that support production occur in both fields of activity. If you have a musical city or a city with a musical climate or culture that doesn't have a lot of venues for consumption, whether it be consumption of recorded music or consumption of live music. Live music is probably particularly important for reasons we can get into if you want to. But if you have a city that doesn't have those, it tends to hobble the ability of a lot of music workers to learn, because that learning goes on through mixtures of consumption and production, or at least makes that line very difficult to draw. That's one of the nice things about being in the music field, of course. But I want to talk about another thing that we learn from public spaces and also from networked media. It's not something you only learn face to face. This is something that comes from both sources. And it's what I call an affective function, which is used to characterize a space and or a situation with associated energy or emotion. Learning this is not in itself urban by nature. As I said, it can be learned in a networked way. But it is crucial in how music functions in the clusters of musical production that tend themselves to form in urban centers. And we mentioned Jonathan Stern. Jonathan Stern published a sort of classic article in Natural Musicology, I think in 97.
Is it 97?
Yes. I wasn't looking. In 97, called Sounds Like the Mall of America, that talks about precisely how the stores in the Mall of America, which is a big mall in Minneapolis, second biggest indoor shopping mall in the world, how the stores characterize the spaces with the kinds of music that they use. This is before he published his book. Of course, we also learn music's affective function from electronic multimedia, from music recordings, from films, from television, internet videos, what have you, in which the music is used to tell us how to feel about the things that we're seeing. And most people who are alive today, of course, have learned these things literally from the beginning of their consciousness of the world. There are very few people who are so old that that's not true of them. And these sources of music's affective function are not necessarily agglomerated in these cities, but work through multiple networks of multiple media experience as well. Now, of course, there's nothing particularly new about this affective function of mine, which I'm describing. It's been described in any number of ways, right, from any number of theoretical approaches. What I'm suggesting that is novel, though, is that this function seems to be intertwined in urban musical communities with the kinds of music learning that I've been describing. In other words, learning the affect of music is something that is also done socially. In just those kind of face-to-face situations that are underlined by Storper and Venables, by Alan Scott, the people whose names I had up before, and is ultimately inseparable from the development of musical taste. And we learn emotional responses to music from social situations as well as from individual reflection. And they are key to musical learning in urban musical clusters, as well as the kinds of musical networks modeled by Basba Herb and other urban geographers who are starting to look into music from the other end, rather than musicologists like me who become amateur urban geographers. And so those shared responses to live music performance, listening to new bands, listening to DJs, listening to music styles, have their own forms of socially performed reception. And learning those, again, is inseparable from learning affect and learning taste. All of what I've said so far seems to argue that spaces of socialization for musical workers and musical performances that interest them may be as crucial for the success of musical clusters. In other words, for concentrated musical production in an urban center, as those factors that are normally discussed in the literature. The need for musical performance spaces that attract other musical workers when they are active in the same cluster might indeed provide an alternative explanation for the very often remarked phenomenon of the musically cool cities, like Manchester in the 1990s, or Seattle in the 1980s, or even Liverpool in the 1960s. It might also suggest an explanation for why it may often be so difficult for urban planners to create successful musical buzz. No matter how carefully they plan it, no matter how well-funded it all is, a sense of what will attract musical workers to social and music venues is not part of the normal requirement for becoming an urban planner. Maybe it should be. The kinds of musical learning that go on in these spaces of consumption and production should be distinguished from notions of musical influence. Even though the examples that I cited might suggest otherwise, you can learn the parameters of music, feeling, and creativity in these situations, but that does not necessarily amount to emulation. I'm not talking about the spread of style here. Locations that are rich in interpersonal interactions and the sharing of aesthetic values do tend, however, to set parameters, assumptions, sometimes spoken, sometimes not spoken, that outlined at least a field of possibility and of assessment in which musical producers can operate. And those parameters can sometimes work, like many aesthetic judgments, on a fairly abstract level, which also, of course, tends to protect them from conscious scrutiny, with the ideology of individuality serving as a strong counterforce. So in any musical community, you have this very interesting tension going on, whereby there is a sharing of aesthetic values and outlooks at a very abstract level, and at the same time, a very strong ideology of individuality, that everybody is doing something unique and has his or her own take. And actually, that kind of conflict is one of the things that becomes creative about musical spaces, about urban musical spaces. Okay. People always want examples. Nobody likes pure theory. What happened to pure theory? So, I got a couple of examples. In a publication that was supposed to be out by now, but has still not come out, I took a look at three recordings from the early period of HIP, of Historically Informed Performance. Some of the early, really early period instruments recordings of Beethoven's symphonies. And I took a few of these, and I picked almost at random last movement of Beethoven's First Symphony, Opus 21. You all know how this goes? I did that one. So I just took these and I used the software called Sonic Visualizer, and I managed to get with some mathematical, I actually had to revive some math I hadn't done since high school. I'd completely forgotten how to do logarithms. I had to relearn that. My son helped teach me. And I ended up measuring the instrumental balance of these recordings. Those of you who are old enough to remember this will know, or maybe if you're interested in the history of HIP performance, if you're interested in the history of HIP, you might know this as well, that some of the early virtues that were touted for HIP had to do with instrumental ballads, right? We're using the old instruments, we're using proper sized ensembles. Now finally we get the winds and the strings, you know, going right without the strings overwhelming the winds. You must have heard about this at some point. It was a big deal. So I went and measured these things because I wanted to know whether these values were really circulating, and if so, how they were circulating. And I ended up finding, I hate to spoil the surprise when the thing hasn't even come out, but I ended up finding that there seemed to be a way of doing instrumental balance that was particular to London musicians. That there seemed to be aesthetic criteria that were circulating among the many musicians in London who sort of crisscrossed the London hip scene, often playing as freelancers in each other's projects as well. And of course, by the way, I wasn't just talking about performing musicians, I was also talking about engineers and producers, because anytime you analyze a recording, you have to understand you're dealing with very important sources of mediation. But it actually worked very nicely for my argument, because I was really talking about the kinds of aesthetic criteria that tend to get shared in recording studios as well. So that was sort of one of my examples that I came up with. But I suspect that, again, if you retain an appropriate level of abstraction in looking for these kind of intra-urban similarities, you might even find them in popular genres. Perhaps even, dare I say it, in indie rock groups, the very emblems of individuality. And so I looked at a couple of indie groups, Arcade Fire and Stars. I'm assuming at least Arcade Fire is known here? Yes? Right. Stars are a little less known. They're somewhat known in North America. And Stars actually got their start not in Montreal. Arcade Fire, of course, comes out of Montreal indie scene. Stars got started in Toronto and tried to establish themselves in New York. Didn't quite do it, and ended up in Montreal. But both bands developed their sound within Montreal's extremely vibrant and very active indie scene around the same time, and both of them released albums in 2004. Arcade Fire's album then was Funeral, and Stars released Set Yourself on Fire. So I'm just going to play a little bit of a song from each. You know, I don't want to play you too much, just enough to make my point. So I'll play you a little bit of Arcade Fire's song, Neighborhood Number 2, Laika. And then I'll go on to a Stars song. So here's Neighborhood 2. So this is from the 2004 album, Funeral. Thank you. I'll play you also a little of Stars, Your Ex-Lover Is Dead, which is the opening song from Set Yourself on Fire. You'll hear in the beginning the thing that gives the album its name, although the title song is actually second song. The excerpt that you'll hear, in case it interests you, it may not, is you'll hear an actor. It sounds like a sample, but it's actually not. It's Torquil Campbell, the lead singer's father, is an actor, and he actually recorded the little quotation you hear at the beginning. But anyway, that's just a distraction. So here you go. Whoops.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
I'm going to try that again. You know, try it like this. No, that's not going to work.
The help is on its way. I think. Okay, here it is.
C'est lui ce matin qui est venu me voir pour me demander si j'avais réussi à me connecter à Internet. Oui. Sur Windows, c'est toujours compliqué, je crois. Non, mais...
Thank you. Forget about shut the PowerPoint, you're gonna have to look at me.
Yes.
No one ever said it would be easy.
No.
All right, so here we go. Your ex-lover is dead.
When there's nothing left to burn, you have to set yourself on fire.
That's the guy's. Sometimes very much highlighted, as in that second song, in both of these examples. This is not to say by any means that these groups sound alike. On the contrary, for one thing, Stars, the second group here, actually uses a much greater variety of sources for its complex textures and its non-standard instrumentation. The next song in this album, by the way, the one that's actually called Set Yourself on Fire, uses a great deal of synthesized sound. And of course, before this album, their music was even more solidly kind of electro-pop. But these common aspects could begin to suggest a shared set of aesthetic judgments at some level of abstraction formed in circumstances of face-to-face interaction. Not necessarily between members of the two respective bands, of course they do know each other, but more important, with other workers in the musical clusters of Montreal at that time. So, engineers, producers, A&R staff, talent bookers, audiences, all of whom are intimately involved in the acts of aesthetic appreciation and judgment and production. Audiences only indirectly, all of these other players quite directly. Now, of course, these face-to-face developed aesthetic parameters and judgments are only a part of what goes into musical creativity. And it's an activity that's both social and individual, and one that, even to the extent that it's social, can occur in a lot of network situations that do not involve geographic locality or face-to-face communication. So I'm not making a claim that's supposed to be all-encompassing. There are at least as many differences as similarities between Arcade Fire's music and Star's music, and you could find others if you listen to a lot more of their music, and similarly, any differences between those two London-based Beethoven recordings that I discussed in my article can just as validly be underlined as their similarities. But the point here is not to argue any overall similarity or difference among these locally-based musical commodities. Instead, what I'm arguing is that music is particularly susceptible to the kinds of face-to-face transmissions that Storper and Venables, among others, discuss, and to argue for its development and transmission in places of work and places of leisure, and to suggest finally that musicology has something to offer in this equation. This is knowledge, the knowledge that's communicated among music workers, the music clusters, is, after all, musicological knowledge. Not necessarily worded in our professional language, usually not, but rather usually conveyed in either summary judgment or a musicological vernacular of the popular music world. Although in the cases of the hip performers that I discussed in my article, maybe there's more of a mixture of that vernacular with conservatory cultivated language. But we do have ways of making explicit, musicologist status, of making explicit and bringing into focus aspects of music that are not always formulated pragmatically. For example, the aspects of texture that I compared between Arcade Fire and Stars are often mentioned by critics and audiences, sometimes performers as well, as lush or soft. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with such descriptions, but identifying texture and instrumentation does undermine more specifically factors that might be operating in socially shared aesthetic values. And it allows us to speculate in a more detailed way about the kinds of things that might make music clusters work in cities. Of course, we don't have to be professional musicologists to translate these descriptions into more helpful formulations. And I'm not suggesting that every urban planner trying to build cultural quarters with a musical component needs a musicologist at his or her side. Although if you are an urban planner and are planning this, we can talk. But I'm suggesting that musicologists might be able to offer helpful ideas of how musical clusters or music cities, whatever you want to call them, I'm guesting at a conference next month in Hamburg, it's called Hamburg Music City. So a lot of cities are now trying to brand themselves as music cities. So I'm trying to offer helpful ideas of how music cities and musical clusters find ways of succeeding and how it is that creative musicians operate in urban space. After all, we work closely with musicians as music professors, albeit in more formal environments than they normally operate. And we have some ideas about how they learn, not just performing musicians, but also the engineers, producers, A&R executives, which many of our students, at least a lot of the students that I've taught, go on to become. I don't know about you, but a lot more of my students go on to become music industry workers, non-performing music industry workers, then go on to become performers by quite a margin. Make that go to weird places. Regardless of any practical role that we might see for music scholars in planning cultural quarters, there can be little doubt that the kinds of productive learning discussed by economic urban geographers concerning the knowledge-based economy are particularly central to music learning and production. This might at the minimum argue that the kinds of spatially dependent buzz so widely discussed weigh unusually heavily in music contexts, and that we have to think of agglomerated musical activity as a special case of creative labor. Maybe not categorically, but perhaps quantitatively. And quantitative difference, of course, can be all the difference. And we can't help but wonder, or at least I can't help but wonder, whether the modest performance of musical clusters observed by scholars like Evans, you were supposed to have that reference right in front of you there, but about a year ago, a fellow named Evans published a very comprehensive article in the journal Urban Studies arguing that the successes of musical clusters or musical quarters, whatever you want to call them, the terms change every few years, it's basically the same thing, that the claims for success have been greatly exaggerated, and that actually music is much less helpful in urban growth than is often claimed. So, I can't help but wonder, having read that, whether the modest performance that he's describing might find some of its basis, at least, in undue consideration of these kinds of factors. All in all, it's tough for me to believe that those of us who study the transmission of musical style and taste both historical and contemporary, have nothing to offer to those who are trying to create conditions for exactly that kind of transmission. While we hardly enjoy the same priorities or views of the world as most urban planners and many economic geographers and sociologists, trust me, urban scholars and musicologists nevertheless actually have a lot to offer each other. And it would behoove us to discover the new and potentially exciting forms of knowledge that lie within each other's purview. A previously little explored vista of urban musical creation awaits us, and I, for one, am eager to glimpse it. Thank you.